this is the first of a series of six talks on the compound nature of the human being. And because of the factors involved all the way along, I make a sort of a preamble out of this, setting the foundation as it was more or less laid for us by Paracelsus von Hohenheim. According to Paracelsus, there are two books, the great book of the universe and the little book, which is man. To Paracelsus and many other physicians of that early period, the human body was the most available text for the whole world, for all the things that happen everywhere, anytime. Because somewhere within the microcosm, which is man, all the processes of the macrocosm are unfolded. George Gallup, the man who did the Gallup poll and was a great assembler of information, said that to him it was utterly inconceivable that the amount of information in the human body is available to measure every other mystery of the universe. We have lived with this body to find it mostly creaky and a little uncertain, and do not realize the tremendous scope of wonders that are taught by the body to help us to chart the universe and all of its processes. It was, of course, Paracelsus who declared that there were three parts to the human body, as there are three parts to the world. There is the spiritual part, the invisible causal nature. There is the lower part, the body. The physical form, which also exists, is to be found and be found throughout nature. And between these two, the man and the space, there is a middle distance, which has been called the mind or the reasoning faculty. So man is spirit, mind, soul, and body. The universe is spirit, mind, soul, and body. And these departments or divisions were the basis of most ancient reasoning and reckoning. But there's an interesting point here that I don't think anyone is making. I've never seen it made, and I've never seen a real definite effort to understand it in the large and important terms with which it can be involved. Actually, there are two functions in man that we have to consider: thought and memory. The individual is the thinker who remembers. Now, this is very ordinary and sounds very simple, but it is the source of infinite confusion. The thinker is an entirely different function of the compound human being from the digester or memorizer. All memorized facts are static. All facts which arise from the direct observation of realities are, we say, active. Now, the development of the memory has to a great degree burdened mankind from the beginning of time. We are depending more and more upon what we remember, and less about the original thinking of which we are capable. The thinking is an active process. Whatever is thought may be later recorded and put on paper or on a cylinder or stored away in the memory. Memory is a storehouse, but it is of very little use unless there's something to store in it. And this has been where the weakness has been in our modern thinking. When we go back to the ancients, when the life was comparatively simple and carvings on the walls of caves were about all the records we had, the factor of thought was much more dynamic than it is today. Because the native of that time had no memories to fall back upon, there was no previous history of the world in which he lived. There was no previous account of the adventures of others like himself, because he had no record and no written form to tell him what to do in an emergency. He was gradually forced to a very positive position. He had to think. He had to try to find the answers for himself, by himself. He had to try to figure out what to do when the cave bear attacked him. He had to find out what to do when he was stricken with an ailment or suffered from an accident. These things could not be taken out of books. He could not consult a physician. He knew no way to function except through his own personal initiative. He had one, however, one factor in his favor. He was capable of an intimate and immediate religious reaction. Not knowing what to do and how, where to find help, he called upon the deities or upon the spirits or upon the mysteries of the air to give him advice. And out of this we have the seers and the sibyls, those who sought to lead the individual in ways of thoughtfulness before the individual was really doing any basic thoughtfulness for himself. Therefore, we have thought, which is the process of examination, and we have memory. Now, if we apply this to the human body, we will find that the thought is still working in the laboratory, and the memory is in hundreds of volumes of recorded research. Now, these hundreds of volumes sound very, very important. But one of the things we have discovered in the course of time is that all these volumes put together do not give us the immediate answers that we want for the problems of daily living. We have got to think today in order to survive. And all the books in the world cannot bestow salvation upon us, because these books are memories. Memories that come and arise from the past, and our problems arise right now here. We have to use new agencies of thought. We have to use the mind as we have never used it before if we want to solve the problems of our time. The only thing that memory can bestow is a certain amount of consolation, a lead or two as to where in the past something similar may have occurred. But if we go back to that past when that something may have occurred, we will find the situation so basically difficult and different that we do not find the answer there that we are seeking now. Science, therefore, is a great recorder of knowledge. But in the last analysis, science is also hopelessly dependent upon original thought. And thought is the problem that we are all working with very closely and very sincerely today. Now let's see what this all means in terms of the human being. We know the individual, everyone living in this world, has the capacity to think. And to think is to give an expression to a basic mental principle within ourselves. This basic mental principle is not infallible. It does not mean that we can forget everything else simply by thinking, but it means that this mental faculty is indispensable in an effort to understand the physical phenomena of life. It cannot solve problems beyond itself, but it is very necessary to achieve the immediate information we need for daily living. So we try to figure out how we shall do some original thinking. Now, original thinking means that we have to have a disciplined mind. It cannot drift around in the vagaries of uncertainty. We cannot have a mind laden with superstition and expect it to serve us in time of emergency. There is tremendous importance, therefore, in mental training. The mental organization and the preparation through education of the mind for the responsibilities of personal decision. In the present educational system, we have virtually no mental training. In there, we are depending upon textbooks, which are nothing but memory. They're what somebody else said long ago. And we give that to the children of today and expect them to find the answers to their problems. These answers are not there. They are in spirit, perhaps, they're in substance or in symbolism, partly expressed. But the average young person today does not know how to take memories and transform them into dynamic, immediate decisions. Now, working with this problem and working with the memory factor that is so very, very important, we then come to a very interesting and, I think, very profitable conclusion. Today, we are working to get our way out of a complicated situation. We are seeking more and more answers to the basic problems of life. So what have we done? We have finally, to crown everything else, invented a computer. And what is a computer? It is nothing but a mechanical memory. A computer cannot answer any question that has not already been answered. It cannot come to any conclusion which cannot be gained or brought back from previous conclusions. The computer is not a thinker. It is a rememberer. We can put great volumes of statistics into the computer, and they will come out in a bit more orderly way. But all the computers in the world will not teach us how to get out of debt, because it cannot create thought. It cannot take ideas and transform them into immediate, active realities. It can give us all kinds of hunches and suggestions and opinions and beliefs, but they are all based upon something that was known before, something that existed in the time when the Chinese were shaking their oracle bones. So we have here a new way of remembering, and it probably was going to take over very heavily our educational system. But when it has done this, what are we going to have? Are we actually going to have an answer to anything other than maybe a more efficient way of doing something we've been doing all the time? We cannot expect the computer to think. And we laughingly believe that it thinks. We like to hope that it could think. Because if it could only think for us, we might be out of trouble, because we've never been able to think for ourselves. And this is always a rather disillusioning and discouraging discovery. But at the present time, we are very carefully educating people for the problems of computerization. We are going to be able to feed all kinds of facts into the instrument, and it's going to come out with all kinds of answers. But these answers are not going to be beyond the sphere of the physical information that we can pour into the computer. Now, if we poured into the computer all that we know about man, we probably would come out with some rather complicated findings. We would realize that probably none of us have ever thought of all that is thinkable about the human state. We would also find a certain number of facts, which are in themselves very important. Facts have to be there. But facts are also static unless the mind renders them dynamic. The mind has to put life into facts. It has to take the fact and use it to accomplish a specific purpose, or the fact is not useful. So we can get all kinds of facts. For instance, we can be told by a computer that we should love each other, but that does not end war. We can be told by the computer that it is perfectly possible to do a better job at bookkeeping than we do now. This can be accepted and will prove to be true. So we will accept the fact about the bookkeeping, but we know that we have no answer about the war. All of these things remind us that no instrument that man develops on himself can be more enlightened than the person that develops it. And that also, in this case, that we are developing in the study of the human body, its anatomy, physiologies, and functions, a great deal of information that can be very valuable to us. But if this valuable information is simply fed into an instrument, it will come out with no more answers than perhaps the Aborigines had long ago, because there is no solution in merely finding the answers that are already there. But of course, there are always some. There are some answers to problems we haven't thought much about. We might get some secondary information. But the primary problem of where we're going from here has to be mastered by the mystery of the mind itself, and not by any form of computerization or the regimentation of knowledge in retrospect or in anticipation. We are therefore right now on the problem of looking at the human body as it was looked at by those long ago. There was a time when our actual information was very limited. Therefore, all knowledge had to be from experience. The individual in a little tribe of a half a dozen natives somewhere in the valley of the Rhone had to live the best he could in a cave with a stone axe. Everything that happened to him was very real, very definite, and very consecutive. He did not know how to solve these problems, but it gradually dawned upon him that there had to be an answer. And the first answers that he thought of were religious. He thought that somewhere there was a spirit or a god or a soul or something that was available to him in a great emergency. And he was in a great emergency all the time, so that he had to constantly beseech this power, whatever it was, and however it worked, to help him. Now, he didn't know at that time, however, of what you might say is positive thinking. We use positive thinking a great deal to solve problems these days. And he did it, but he didn't know it. His positive thinking was to think there was something better than he was that could take care of him. He didn't think he could do it for himself, but he thought it could be done. And that began the development of theologies and philosophies and moral systems. They were all part of man's desperate determination to answer the hurt that he had today. He could remember the hurts of yesterday and what caused them. That might prevent him from repeating the hurt. But in the history of civilization, the repetitions of hurt as seldom had ever been identical. And the man who had a hurt a week ago learned something from it may get no helpful information from another hurt today or next week. Each situation is a complete problem in itself. And the only way to meet the complete problem of mankind is by the complete use of the faculties which we have been given to solve problems with. Now, in our first talk of this series, the problems we are discussing are physical. They will come very well, therefore, under the general heading of science. And we know from the history of science several things that are important. We get a hint about science from tradition, from memory. Memory, if we look up science in the dictionary, we find out what the memory of science is. And we find out what it was supposed to do, how it was supposed to do it, and what its best conclusions were. Now, these conclusions may not be too good, and many of them will have to be rejected, and many of them have been completely contradicted. But there are some that have stood the weight and time of years. And these we have to study in terms of scientific. But the moment we come to a scientific problem, then we have to turn it over to the mind. Because no scientific problem is completely solved. It is in some form of being solved, or it is being rejected as not possibly to be solved. But anyway, we'll assume that the mind takes over the problem. Now, it can then immediately look it up in the best book on the subject, and will then find the memory of that problem. It will find the memory of the Spanish Inquisition. It will find the memory of the Crusades. It will remind us of the wars that have gone, the great wars of Attila and Alaric. It will teach us a little bit about the Charlemagne and Napoleon and Hitler and Mussolini and Stalin. And will give us a very interesting cross-section of all these things. But what we're reading is memories. Therefore, we can find out what happened, but memory cannot tell us what to do about it. Memory can only recall that this was an outrage, or this was a terrible thing. We've had those kind of answers for centuries. In the present century, we have had the two worst wars in history, and behind this is over 3,000 years of records of these things, but still no solution. We know, for instance, that war is what it is, but how to do something about it? So today, the foremost nations of the world are trying to figure out what to do about it. And their first job has been to go back into the memory bank and see what was there and to find out why these things happened. And they, with the aid of the memory bank, they have found out what happened and why and how it happened. But it ends as a statistic. There is nothing in the memory bank that can give them a clear vision of solution. The memory bank may be morally informative. It may just tell us all that we shouldn't fight. But this doesn't solve the problem. We also have the consideration of that from memory of all the various experiments that we try in daily living, our paying bills, whether we live within our means, and all these things are in the memory bank. But when it comes to daily life, we more or less ignore that. We do not learn from experience. We keep right on trying to do it our way. We can read from the memory bank of other people, as in the case of narcotics addiction, and find out what it does, but it does not prevent us from turning in our turn to the same vices and devices. So there's a great problem all now of trying to find out some of the facts about the human being. Facts that were amazingly understood long ago. Understood at a time when there was no way of simply reading your way into a solution. There were ancient writings. There were books on anatomy and physiology in Egypt 4,000 years ago. Even if we could find them all, we'd probably pay no attention to them because they belong to another generation, another world, another time. But they represent the memory bank of how to keep the peace. But all the memories in the world will not keep the peace. For the reason, the ambition of the individual is far too powerful to answer and to respect these discoveries. So the mind must step in and work with the material. It must also add to the memory of the past the experience of now. The mind, therefore, has to work with now. And now, in some way, never quite fits the past. It never quite solves the mysteries of the past. And the mysteries of the past never quite solve the modern problem. The nearest we can gain for moral solution is ethics, which will contribute something. But most people are unwilling to live according to it. Now from the human body, we gain a whole group of interesting facts. As I said, Paracelsus says that there are three parts to the mystery of man. Man as a causal spiritual being, man as an intellectual individual, and man as a physical body. These three correspond to the three worlds recognized by ancient antiquity: heaven, earth, and hell. And the Rosicrucian author Flood made a very good study of this particular point. He shows that for the comparison that the skull seated upon the anchor bridge of the neck represents in this void the intellectual center. The physical center is in the physical body and surrounds the heart and the most vital organs. The combination or union of the two is corresponding with the development of the autonomic nervous system and the upper part of the body. So we have heaven, earth, and hell as brain, heart, and physical abdominal structure. In these Rosicrucian studies, Flood shows a picture of the abdominal cavity, which he describes as hell. And maybe that is the reason why so many individuals have considered our food products and our food habits to be one of the greatest enemies that we have. The individual dies first in the abdominal cavity by the misuse of its functions and by the abuse of its principles. The problem of taking care of that, however, is largely a problem of justice. The individual will find out gradually that nothing he ignores will do him any good.
He cannot think himself out of an action and get anywhere. He cannot forget something he doesn't want to remember and come through in perfect condition. He must recognize that the human body has its requirements. And these requirements on their own plane are the same as the requirements of a nation, of the planet, and of the solar system. Everything that is needed for man is needed also in some form or condition for the whole of the universe, all the way to the ultimate causation. We live in a world, therefore, in which all problems break down into one grand problem. And unless we approach the one grand problem, we cannot get too far with any part of it. Now with man, the governors of man are the mind and the emotion and the physical body. And these three have their private tyrannies and are the causes of most of the problems that we face. These same causes in a nation produce war, bankruptcy, sedition, if abused. These three qualities in the world result in the great natural astronomical phenomena, everything from sunspots to comets. Everything is tied together with one great pattern of ethics, integrity, and values. Now, in many of these mysteries, we have only analogy to help us. We never get close enough to the problem to know exactly what it is. But we can get close enough to realize that wherever there is a problem, something is wrong. And if in our lives we have problems, that something that is wrong is ourselves. We have tried every way possible to push the problem onto someone else. We have tried to blame others for every mistake we make, but we are the ones that suffer. And there is no solution to any of these problems unless we approach the whole subject more or less scientifically. We've got to approach it on the basis of a firm statement of self-responsibility and acceptance. We also have to realize that we cannot depend upon memory for the information that we need. Take, for example, the child goes to school, graduates, and goes into the world. And at this time particularly, any information that he learned when he was 8 or 9 years old in school is liable to be completely wiped out by the time he is 16 or 18 years old. The rules he learned are obsolete before he memorizes them. The situations he thought he was fitting himself to meet no longer exist. The man who spent many years getting a career so that he could become a broker, when he gets it, finds there's so many brokers he can't get a job. All of these things represent an effort to just memorize your way into some kind of security. It can't be done. Today, memory is very, very incomplete and imperfect. The only way where memory is valuable is on the level of morality. But having no longer a security in memory, there's only one thing left to do: think. The individual has got to become capable of self-determinism. He's got to be capable of living his own life. If that is the only way he can manage the universe that is under his own skin. The ancients all realized that if the population of the world were all heaped together, they would not begin to compare with the forms of life that are within the body of one human being. In other words, we would not be able to divide sufficiently. We would realize that perhaps a sun has a greater population than a planet. Tiny, insignificant forms of life that do not last for a breath come by the millions, by the billions. And they all have their parts to play. They are all a part of a great system, a great population, over which the individual as a selfhood is a God, a divine being administering an empire of hundreds of billions of separate living things. Therefore, if he realizes this to a slight degree, he can become a tyrant. But very few people have reached that degree of understanding in which tyranny is possible. They rather remain ignorant and not knowing any part of it, they ignore it all. But we know, for instance, that just as a country will fall apart with bad leadership, our health will fall apart by the bad habits. We realize that can be tyrants, we can become crazy monarchs like the past, we can kill off our subjects, we can impoverish them, we can deprive the people of our inner kingdom of the food they need, of the protection they require, of the management they also must have. In other words, we can take from this little thing which we call the human body a grand pattern of the whole world and all the things that are involved in it. And we know that health today tells us that unless we use certain reasonable care, we will be a bad ruler. Now the world is knows about all bad rulers. It knows about Genghis Khan. It knows about the conquest of Alexander and Napoleon. It knows all kinds of things about selfish people who have destroyed their empires, corrupted their world, and tortured their population. But do we realize that we may be one of them? Only that we don't know what we are doing any more than the despot really knows, because we have allowed our selfishness or our ignorance or our antagonism to destroy the very life of our own bodies, to destroy millions of cells, destroy hundreds of functions simply by a temper fit. If we keep on this way long enough, we'll be in the same way as nations on earth. It will all end in revolution. We are getting over a revolution in China. We're getting over a revolution in India. Also a revolution in all other nations of the world. We have revolutions on every hand. And most of all, we have dyspepsia, which is one of the worst of our private revolutions. We have dyspepsia because we are tyrants, because we pay no attention to the population of our own private world. To find out and understand this, then, begins the problem that we find in all philosophical systems. First of all, get a good government. And a good government means a proper rulership over this little world that we live in. This little world, which to our vigil, the faculties, is very tiny, but in its true substance and essence may be more vast and multiform than the galaxy. But if we want and must be rulers, we should be good rulers. If we are not good rulers, we are tyrants. And if we are tyrants, we destroy our own kingdom. All this is what the people like Agrippa and Paracelsus and Damian all taught and believed. The beginning of a good world situation is an individual who learns to govern little things. And who is made a righteous governor over little things shall be given rulership over greater things. The Bible tells us definitely that we must begin our rulership over little things, and that those little things include mostly our own habits. To get into a condition where we can protect the body means that we are getting ready to go on to unfold a constructive program. A constructive program means that we have to not only have right ideas, but live them. Not only be convinced of truth, but apply them. And under pressure and disappointment and disillusionment, to keep right on doing that which is right. We find that every attitude which will destroy a kingdom, if brought down to the private life of an individual, will destroy health. We find that very definitely that we are custodians. This body is not something that was just pushed in under the spirit to keep it while it was here. This body has been ages in evolving. It has been developed over a vast period of time to make possible the advancement of the internal life of the person. The body does not live for itself any more than humanity on the face of the earth lives for itself. They're all part of something bigger, something greater, and something more important. And it is the recognition of this concatenation of greatness that we should all be working with every day. If we take these written problems that we have, we will find that just as tyrants are selfish and destroy their people, so individuals are selfish and destroy their health. That wherever tyranny comes in, and in some cases tyranny is gratification of undisciplined habits, we may find that the individual will not break habits which will destroy him. So he is destroyed and they blame someone else. When this happens on a larger scale, we call it Alexander the Great. We really always are thinking of great people who make mistakes. But in this little mystery of ourselves, which is a very small but tremendously powerful one, this little mistake is something that can take away the health and endurance of billions of living entities within our own body. All this is something that we do when we study alchemy and chemistry. We have to begin by a profound respect for the economy that makes possible the creature that we are. So we get away from the belief which we have in so many things. For instance, in law, if we don't know how to try the case, we get out the books and we read. And we hope that when we read, we will get the answer. When the individual is sick, we make an examination. But the examination is read according to the experiences of the past. When we prescribe a drug, it is based upon some preparation which we have found in the catalogs of drugs and hope to God it's the right one. And it is the same in politics. When we elect a politician, we go to the Romans or we go to the Greeks or even the Chinese to find out just how it should be done. And we get generally a government of theories and lack of practice. And the Greeks discover that without disciplining ourselves, we have elected an undisciplined body to govern us. So that all the way along, every time an emergency arises, it is a determined fact that we have to be prepared for it. Now, how do we prepare ourselves for these facts? First of all, we must prepare by a series of moral lessons. When we elect someone to public office, we hope we will get the individual who is best qualified. When we try to make decisions of our own, we hope that we are in a condition to make a just and intelligent decision, which may or may not be true, usually is not. So we have to prepare ourselves for responsibility. It has been talked about the importance of having a university for the education of diplomats and those in heavy political positions, that they should be trained particularly for that. Well, you can say the same thing. The entity that lives in our body should have the proper administration, and it should have the watchful care of enlightened electors who know exactly what they are doing and are doing that which is best for all concerned. The experiences which we now recognize, you know, as coming partly at least through memory have their value, but they are only nudging us to go and trying to get us to go on to something better, something more useful, something more wise. We may take an example from one of these, but we can't leave it there. We have to go on. Now we're going to try to go on into the next century. And we're going to try to take this human body, probably, for as many more years as possible. Those in younger years have a good chance of a reasonable length of future, unless they destroy themselves. A country has a good chance for future, unless its government destroys it. In all cases, wherever there is imbalance, wherever there is lack of ethics, sickness begins, political, psychological, physical. So we have to watch constantly, or we will not even survive long enough to make the corrections we'd like to make. So we're going now into the study of this body to find out a little more about it, a little more about how it works and why it works. And we have a body which is a kingdom, or an empire, or a republic, or a commonwealth, and can even become a communistic state. All of these things are possible, and Plato reminds us that all of them are equally meritorious if they are administered with intelligent justice. There is no bad form of government. There is only a misuse of governmental power. Therefore, no matter what the form may be, it will work if it is honest. No matter how gorgeous and elegant and modern and up-to-date it is, it will not work if it is dishonest. So we start with those kind of problems, and we say these all are applicable to health. They're applicable to the problems that come to us in our daily living. They have to do with our gradual and intelligent control of our own functions. It was one of the ancients who gave us the law of the 24-inch rule. The rule of three divisions of a day. A day of 24 hours divided into three sections of 8 hours each. This was the measure of the work of the individual. And these are 3 hours, or three, or 8 hours for work, 8 hours for repose, and eight hours for self-improvement. The individual should set aside his problems in such a way that each of the divisions of his day contributes to his wisdom, his happiness, his security, and his health. If he breaks any of these rules, he is breaking the basic path. He's breaking the foundation of enlightened government. He is breaking the rules of the world in which he lives. Now, these are 24 hours of each day. What are we doing with them now? Well, if we're employed, we're working at something we probably do not greatly enjoy. Maybe we enjoy it a little. And then we go home from that to the next 8 hours. And the chances are that most of those will be spent in front of a television, which itself is not particularly enjoyable. And the other 8 hours will be one thing or another, trying to sleep, trying to get something else done, attempting to go on with other activities, or simply giving up in despair. Maybe doing a little physical exercise just to keep it up. So we have to start in to put regulation into everything, in order that we produce a body capable of giving intelligent commands itself. The government is like the British Parliament. It consists of the House of Lords, and the Lords in these cases are the selves. Your Lord in the government is what you like, what you believe in, what you intend to do anyway. It represents the authority that you have because you are the person in the body. The House of Commons is the body itself. And in most of the old kingdoms, the commons ruled, although not always. The House of Commons means representation by the whole. In other words, in the human body, the House of Commons is composed of every living cell in that body. The House of Lords is the part that has to do with the body what it pleases. But the Commons is the House that has the right to be protected from all abuse by the overlords. If the overlords abuse the body, it will be sick. If they refuse to contribute to the well-being of a community, the community is sick. So a beginning of our understanding is to recognize the physical body as a political empire, as a moral world, as a religious sphere, as a chemical and physical body. All these different things are in the body. And to have a healthy body, you've got to keep the rules. Whenever a tyrant rules the body, we have dissipation and death. Where a fanatic rules the body, we may have all kinds of tortures and starvation, privation, and self-sacrifice, but too much. Whenever economics guards the body, we'll be in trouble all the time. Where if we go on to some particular profession, we go into law, then that God controls the body. Everything we do, we use part of the physical body's resources to do it. And wherever these resources are abused, we have terrible trouble. Because finally, there's something else that we have not yet much considered. And that is, that we'll get in our discussions later, but I'll bring it in just for a moment, beyond the body and beyond what it has to do and beyond the controls which it exercises, behind and beyond the mind and the memory, is an infinite integrity which cannot be compromised. It will go on forever. When we break the laws of that, then we are in definite danger. And we break the laws of the greater when we break the laws of the lesser. For these laws operate in every human body, in the stomach, in the spleen. They relate to every phase we have. But behind all of the others, phases, is the immutability of the simple fact that it must be right or it is wrong. That there can be no compromise between integrity and self-indulgence. There can be no substitute for the recognition that right is right. Now it sounds, of course, as though right might be terrible that way. Right sounds like a police state, but it isn't. Right has never been obtrusive. You never know.